Onto Fisher versus Community Banks of Colorado.
May it please the court. My name is Philip Bledsoe, registration number 33606. I represent Mr. Yale Fisher, who is the appellant herein. When a bank or any business operates so far beyond the norm, it can be difficult to fit that conduct into rules that are set out for the norm. And that's what happened here. Because the court's initial ruling on the credit agreement statute of frauds did not fit, the entirety of this case got off the rails from the beginning. And as the court has reviewed this record, you can see time after time the amount of bench conference we had to sort through the difficult application of the CASOF, the credit agreement statute of frauds. And the reason for that, fundamentally, I think, Your Honors, is that it's not a rule of evidence. It's not a rule of contract interpretation. It deals with claims. It doesn't deal with specific evidence. And here, of course, and the intent of the statute is plain, it's to prevent oral requests for extensions of credit. But that's not what we have here. We have a writing, and we have lots of writings. This is not a situation of where Mr. Fisher is trying to imply the existence of a credit agreement. Not trying to imply the existence of forbearance on a foreclosure. We've got a written agreement. It contains discretion within the operation on behalf of the bank, and that directly implicates the duty of good faith and fair dealing that comes with this contract. And it comes with a written contract, including the original promissory note and loan documents, and the later changes in terms, the CITs. And of course, embedded within the CIT in this second CIT in this case is one of the statements that we claim to be fraud, a statement that is in writing and therefore by itself cannot violate the credit agreement statute of frauds. And that's a statement that says all other terms remain the same. That's in writing. It's not barred. Now, the fact of the matter is, of course, that statement is wrong. Because one term changed, and the significant term that changed was alteration of the default interest rate from 6% to 36%. That's a material misrepresentation, and it sets out a claim for fraud that ought to be allowed on the remand that we are requesting that this court do.
Isn't the first claim it sets out at one of contract interpretation? What did the parties intend to be their default interest rate? I mean, your argument, as I understand it, is that there's a conflict in the second change agreement.
There is plenty of conflict, Your Honor. The court did rule below, and we urge that as error as well, that the contract was somehow unambiguous. We think plainly it is ambiguous. And evidence about that, how that 36% was inserted, should have been directly pertinent and allowed, and it was excluded. And one of the things you've got here is in the administration of this loan, of how the foreclosures were handled and how the bank was involved within the bankruptcy process, whereas the pinnacle of what our claim of bad faith is you've got an affidavit filed in the bankruptcy court, admittedly false, that says this 36% was heavily negotiated.
You say it was admittedly false. Is there something in the record that, and I realize that the evidence was excluded. Was there an offer of proof as to what
there is, Your Honor. There is, Your Honor. And I actually believe in the admitted evidence, Ms. Taylor did actually admit that, who was the witness, who was the affiant, admitted that at a minimum it was incorrect. And I believe that evidence also came in through Mr. Hatch, who testified as well. And so
was the incorrectness testimony or simply with respect to the heavily negotiated portion of the affidavit that had been filed?
Well, I think it was, Your Honor, and in all honesty, the record, as the court knows, is quite voluminous. And I believe her deposition testimony, which actually shows her admissions of it being incorrect and not accurate, were included in a voluminous offer of proof that was made at the trial. But all of that really is important, because when the case gets off the rails so early, as it did here, when the car gets off the racetrack and is damaged, it's never going to have a chance to catch up. And that's why the repeated misapplication of the credit agreement statute of frauds requires, on the claims that we have requested in this case, reversal and remand for a new trial.
So is it my understanding that your argument hinges on the concept that the agreement was ambiguous? Because if it were not ambiguous, then would extrinsic evidence have been admissible?
It does not hinge on that. It is an independent basis, Your Honor, because the claim for good faith and fair dealing does allow us to introduce evidence of how this credit was administered throughout the entirety. Because remember, what we're talking about here is the frauds committed. Actually, interestingly enough, the evidence plainly shows is that the bank lied to the person it sold the note to, the folks at Western, about whether or not they had been accruing and charging this default interest. The actual evidence is, of course, they didn't even know it was in there till near the end of the game. And once they discovered that spread between 6% and 36%, that was used by Community Bank to parlay this note to Western. And in the course of that, they told Western that they'd been charging that rate all along. But the evidence doesn't support that. And again, that's some of that actually trickled into the case. Some of it is in the offer of
what trickled well. Into the record?
Trickled into the record. Thank
what,
you.
Yes. What is in the record on that,
Scott? I believe that there is some record evidence, Your Honor, although that they've lied to Western. That Western was believed that they had been fibbed to or misrepresented. I believe there is some evidence in the record before the jury on that. I think when you look at the notion here, it seemed to be quite a bit that somehow the claim for good faith and fair dealing couldn't be included within a claim because of the existence of Kassoff. But the case law in this state's plain that it can. Amoco. Versus Irvin and Wells Fargo versus Uali, and particularly Wells, because it involves a financial institution decided after implementation enactment of the Kassoff statute in 1989, plainly allows a claim for good
faith. But not mentioning Kassoff.
It does not mention Kassoff, and I suspect the reason, and you can't tell from the opinion, I suspect the reason is because the credit agreement, like this case, was in writing. There wasn't any issue about an oral statement for extension of credit.
Yeah, but it's hard to rely on precedent that doesn't deal with the core issue. We're all guessing. What did the panel, was it raised, was it waived, was it, it's kind of hard to use that as affirmative precedent.
There is no discussion of Kassoff in the Wells case. There is, however, in the case cited by the bank, the Colorado Co-Bank ACB, the 10th Circuit case, specifically references and concludes that, of course, Kassoff doesn't bar a good faith and fair dealing case when you've got a written agreement. That case was decided on a summary judgment basis on a different issue, but plainly recognizes the vitality when, as here, the underlying facts are sufficient to show that. I want to speak to show a good faith and fair dealing claim. I want to speak briefly to the counterclaim and then reserve the balance for rebuttal. The counterclaim issue here is based entirely on a case called Ford versus Summer Tree Lane. And in all due respect with the trial court, they got it exactly backwards. In Ford, a general warranty deed was used to convey real property. And in that case, the conclusion was that that conveyance of real property, that general warranty did not convey a personal property, which isn't specifically a chosen action. And here, even though it is claimed in the papers by CBC that somehow it is vague and indefinite, I think is the phrase from the brief, what the bill of sale says is any and all claims and causes of action of CBC, whether known or unknown, against any person or entity under the loan, which is in any way based upon, arising out of, or is related to the said loan or documents. I don't know how it can be drafted any broader than that. That's not vague. That is not indefinite. That is intended to convey all and everything. And the kind of mischief that will occur with all due respect, if this court does not say that in terms of lawyers and parties and clients relying on the language they write in contracts, will be a problem. I will reserve the balance of my time.
5 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jake Matter. I represent the appellee, Community Banks of Colorado. My bar number is 32155. We are here this afternoon because in February of 2003, Mr. Fisher defaulted under a $3.5 million commercial purpose construction loan agreement. We're here this afternoon because for the last 5 years, Mr. Fisher has been attempting to amend, cancel, and modify his representation that he read each and every term contained in the party's credit agreement, including the 36% default interest rate contained in the second and the third loan extensions.
So the bank also made a representation in that second agreement.
Yes.
And that representation, that there were no changes.
That's correct.
And no changes other than those specified. And that representation is false.
No, sir, I believe it's not.
It's not?
It's not.
All right, so at the end of change agreement one, what was the default interest rate?
The note rate.
Okay, at the end of change agreement two, what was the default interest rate?
36%.
This seems like a change.
It is a change.
It seems like the bank said there are no changes.
That's correct. That's exactly
what
it said.
So how do you square those two?
By applying rules of contractual construction.
Maybe so, but and under that rule of construction that you've argued for, you're not giving effect to the representation that there are no other changes, because you're saying give effect to a change, even though we said there are no other changes. So you're saying wipe out that clause and give effect to the more specific, you would argue, 36% rate.
That's correct.
Okay, but you're saying don't give effect to all the clauses.
No, what I'm saying is applying the rules of contractual construction and reading the agreement as a whole, there can only be one reasonable conclusion that the default interest rate is 36%.
Therefore, do not give effect to the other paragraph, the paragraph that preceded that, that said there are no other changes from change agreement one to change agreement two. Don't give effect to that.
I'm not asking for it to be disregarded. I'm asking for it to be read in context in the entirety of the agreement.
But if you read it alone? But if you stop there,
if
how
it
about
was read in isolation,
yes.
That's correct. Mr. Fisher's core theory that if you stop reading the second extension 2 inches down, that's correct. I intend to focus my efforts this afternoon on three issues. One is the proper application of Kassoff. The second is why the contract, the party's credit agreement, is in fact unambiguous. And thirdly, why the economic loss rule bars Mr. Fisher's tort claims for negligent misrepresentation and fraud. First, the credit agreement statute of frauds is a substantive bar to claims just like Mr. Fisher's in this case. It's a categorical bar on certain types of claims for fraud in the inducement, for oral forbearances, and other financial accommodations which a lender could or should have made or considered with respect to a borrower. There are no exceptions to Kassoff, including the I didn't read it exception. Now, in this case, Kassoff was applied in two important respects. First was the trial court's ruling on the motion in limine, which occurred approximately a month before the trial occurred in August of 2008. And the trial court properly barred Mr. Fisher from amending and rescinding and altering his written representation in both the second and the third change in terms agreements that he, in fact, read those agreements. Now, secondly, the credit agreement statute of frauds was properly applied with respect to the omnibus motion in limine.
Does it have the effect of being an evidentiary rule as well? Does it go to clients?
To me, they're one and the same in some respects. It's clearly a rule of substantive law, just like the parole evidence rule is a rule of substantive contract law that has evidentiary implications. So I think, first and foremost, it's a rule of substantive law. It's a substantive bar to certain sorts of claims that it then becomes necessary to enforce as a rule of evidence, as in this case, when the plaintiff intends to pursue claims that are clearly barred by the statute. Now, the second application was with respect to the motion in limine, and this court's responsibility is to review cast-off rulings as a matter of law, and it's also incumbent upon the court to review the offer of proof by reference to the purpose for which the evidence was intended or presented initially in the trial court. And then in this case, if you look at the offer of proof, it is plainly objectionable. The purposes for which Mr. Fisher was offering this evidence were plainly objectionable, meaning all of this evidence went to community banks should have given Mr. Fisher more time and should have given him more money to complete the underlying construction project. And that is plainly objectionable under Kassoff, because once you deviate from the terms of the written credit agreement by extending more money or extending more time, that is in and of itself a amendment to the credit agreement, which must be in writing, which community banks must agree to.
Wasn't part of the offer of proof addressed to the issue of whether there had been any agreement in fact or with respect to the 36% default interest?
Some of the internal bank documents, for example, the loan presentations, were barred under Kassoff and are also properly barred under the parole evidence rule. Yes, parts of the offer of proof were internal bank documents, loan presentations, loan committee minutes, discussing extensions, discussing other potential financial accommodations that the bank sometimes considered and followed through with, and sometimes considered and did not follow through with for whatever reason.
I could follow up on that answer to Judge Kopelke. You mentioned it's barred by the parole evidence agreement, and that would depend on it being an integrated, unambiguous contract. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that will get to your second point. But apart from the Kassoff bar in it, I don't understand how a written internal bank document would be barred by Kassoff. Kassoff talks about a credit agreement is barred unless it's in writing and signed by the party against whom enforcement sought. I mean, why would a written admission of a bank ever be barred by Kassoff?
Well, it's the documents contained in the offer of proof were not a contract, were not an offer to extend credit. They were internal discussions about what to do. And Mr. Fisher was offering those documents to show, A, that community banks considered making a potential financial accommodation to Mr. Fisher, and B, was duty bound under the doctrine of good faith and fair dealing to make those accommodations.
And apart from substantive law, which I think you say parole evidence properly substantive law, good faith, fair dealing, substantive law, just Kassoff though. Kassoff, what makes it so broad, one of the things it makes it so broad is that it defines credit agreement to be any rep or warranty, right? And it says
that's correct.
Basically any rep or warranty is barred unless it's in writing. So I don't see how a written rep or warranty is ever barred by Kassoff.
Well, Kassoff also speaks to the internal loan administration documents and representations, warranties, and omissions made during the administration phase of the loan. And that's exactly what those sorts of documents were. And again, they were not a contract, they were not an offer, they were internal bank documents, and Mr. Fisher wanted to use those to show that community banks had an overabundant collateral position or was over-collateralized and should have extended more credit. And that's improper under Kassoff, and it's also improper under the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
And the latter may be correct. I'm still stuck on Kassoff, how that bars it. It's a rep or warranty, or it's something. Where in the language of Kassoff does that bar a written bank document from coming into evidence?
Well, it's objectionable because of for the purpose for which Mr. Fisher was offering it.
That's a matter of relevance or substantive law, but I mean, under Kassoff, the trial court barred a lot of written bank documents under Kassoff.
That's correct.
And I'm struggling seeing how that can possibly be justified under Kassoff. It may be justified under substantive law or evidentiary relevancy, but under Kassoff, how does Kassoff bar a written bank document from coming into evidence?
Well, there were certainly certain limited waivers, and a great deal of those documents did come in through, for example, the affidavit and other documents concerning the administration of loan with respect to the credit, the Mr. Fisher's credit agreement or Mr. Fisher's credit scores, as well as the testimony by Mr. Fisher's expert, William Edwards. So he largely got a great deal of those documents in and that testimony in, but the trial court applied a rather narrow subject matter waiver with respect to certain elements, including the internal bank documents. Now, I also wanted to move on to why the contract is unambiguous. In this case, Mr. Fisher is hanging his hat on the second extension, and he must do that because the ambiguity or the tension about which he complains is not evident or is not on the face of the third extension.
So, I mean, you're right about the second extension.
Well, his argument is that the second is so flawed that it bleeds into the third.
I understand his argument is the second is internally contradictory, therefore ambiguous, and therefore you cannot tell at the time of the second agreement what the intended default interest rate is. And if that's right, I don't see how the third agreement helps clarify that ambiguity.
Well, again,
it says no other terms are changed, but you don't know what the terms of the second one is right are if that position is right about the conflict.
Again, if you stop reading at the second 2 inches down on the page and don't continue down to the fourth inch of the page to find the 36% default interest rate, and you ignore Mr. Fisher's two-time written representation, then that's a potential result. But there's no dispute in this case that Mr. Fisher had the ability to read, and it's generally negligence as a matter of law to sign an agreement without reading it. And for this court to adopt Mr. Fisher's position would be to adopt a per se negligent approach to contractual construction. And I believe under the rules of contractual construction, when there is a tension, it's incumbent upon the court to attempt to resolve that tension with resort to the rules of contractual construction, not reading any phrases in isolation, and attempting to effectuate the reasonable expectations of the parties. And after signing the third extension, there can be no reasonable doubt what the default interest rate was.
Well, looking at the document as a whole, when you have a statement saying there are no other changes from the previous document other than what's stated in this paragraph, and there's another statement saying evidencing a change, what rule of construction do you do to resolve that tension?
Well, I believe it's the rule that the specific clauses apply over a more general clause. And in the Collins versus Ace Mortgage case out of the District of Colorado, that rule was applied in the context of interpreting two conflicting provisions within Mr. Collins' credit agreement. And the conclusion was, the application was, that the more specific provision prevails. So it's consistent with that reading in the specific cast-off context.
Well, there are other rules of construction, one of which is you resolve ambiguities against the drafter.
That's correct.
And that would cut against your position. I mean, and if you're in an ambiguity stage, the normal rule is you consider extrinsic evidence, isn't it?
That's correct.
And the borrower here tried to offer extrinsic evidence, including that the bank never intended that this 36% rate come into effect.
That's
that it was
correct.
An accident of software.
Well, it wasn't an accident of software. That I understand that that's in the brief. And the justification in the brief is that this was some new LaserPro software. There's LaserPro software for the first extension. So all of the extensions are written under the same format electronically. And part of the parole evidence in this case, if it were necessary, would include the hundreds of other borrowers who signed extensions with 36% default interest rates in them. This was a policy bank-wide, and when there was a CCPA claim in this case, all of that evidence was known to Mr. Fisher. This wasn't a one-off mistake, as Mr. Fisher would lead you to believe in the brief.
Is he correct that the loan officer did not know about this change at the time?
She, with respect to the affidavit, she said that's not quite right. And the I believe that was her testimony in her deposition, because she has nothing to do with preparing the loan documents. She is sort of the client liaison, and the loan department, the loan administration department, is responsible for putting the documents together.
Who's the internal bank official that hand-wrote no other changes?
There is no handwritten statement to that effect that I'm aware of.
That was part of the evidence excluded, that there was some handwritten note that I could be wrong on that, though.
No, that's not the case.
Okay. Let me ask you one more question. Explain how the bank has standing to assert a counterclaim, given the broad sweeping language of the assignment to Williams.
Well, I agree. It is very important for the court to review the Ford versus Summer Tree Lane case. And that case says vague and indefinite assignments don't cut the mustard.
But all claims and all causes of action, known or unknown,
That's correct. And the assignment in the Ford versus Summer Tree Lane case was equally broad. And the holding in the Ford versus Summer Tree Lane case says that in order to assign a chosen action, you must identify it with specificity so that you can tell if you're assigning it or not. And there's another important case. The Ford case is important, and the Hexel case out of the Ninth Circuit is also important, which provides that no debtor can ever obtain a benefit by filing fraudulent bankruptcy, by participating in a fraudulent bankruptcy. And in this case, Community Bank's counterclaim relates to Mr. Fisher's prior criminal proceedings and his restitution obligations, which were not listed on his bankruptcy schedules. Therefore, that's the factual basis for part of Community Bank's counterclaim, and it therefore survived the bankruptcy discharge. Thank you, Your Honor. I have no further questions, and ask the trial court be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you. Bailiff, can you add a minute to the appellant's time?
Let me address a couple of things quickly that are plainly rebuttal. The record plainly does show that these handwritten notes were in there. There's reference in our briefing beginning on page 29, where CBC's secretary, not assistant, but officer secretary, I believe, is writing in their own hands. That's referenced on exhibit number 80, which was excluded. A couple other exhibits that were also excluded. So it's plainly part of the record. It's also incorrect to suggest that the transfer language in the general warranty deed in Ford sounds or reads anything like the bill of sale here. What it has is the classic, forgive me, mumbo jumbo associated with the transfer of real property that says, together with, it transfers the real property, together with all singular hereditaments and appurtenances, hereto revisions reversions, remainder and reminders, and all of the estate's right, title, interest, claim to the premises. It conveys real property. It's not at all like the bill of sale that was rendered in this particular case. And let me answer the question about what our evidence was offered to prove. It was offered to prove, among other things, our claim for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And that's offered to demonstrate, as was shown by the plaintiff and affirmed ultimately on appeal in the Wells case, the numerous acts of deception, concealment, and chicanery, which supported, as ultimately affirmed by the court, the finding of breach of good faith and fair dealing. And you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. That's what the teachings of Wells is, that's what the teaching of Amoco is, that the limits that exist in a party's discretion and how it deals with things prevents you from saying, you owe $3.6 million, which is what the bank was telling Mr. Fisher right before they sold the loan. Within 2 months, the claim is that he owes $5.8 million.
The 36% interest is an option with the lender, is it not, under the language?
It certainly, if you believe it is a proper part of the contract, it is within the discretion of the bank to charge up to 36%. Certainly it would be, Your Honor, but obviously for reasons we've set forward, we don't believe it's properly can be considered part of the contract because of the fraud. But even that is 36%. And so when the bank is telling its purchaser, Western, we've been charging and accruing the default interest, that's plainly not true. And that spread is you know, one of the things that results in the significant damage and pressure that's being placed on Mr. Fisher because of the bank's administration of the loan. That's not extension of credit. That's not forbearance. That's not barred by Kassoff. That all deals with a written credit agreement in which the evidence in this particular case, like in Wells, plainly would support, if we had been properly allowed to present our case in an orderly and meaningful way, a demonstration of chicanery, concealment, fraud, all of the kinds of things that would support a jury verdict had the fundamental errors of the court below not been entered into. And it's plain that there is not any basis in the case law, and certainly not under a reading of the statute, that a written bank document shouldn't come in, because it comes in on the issue of good faith and fair dealing to demonstrate the totality of the circumstances. And even the language of the Kassoff statute itself even contemplates oral discussions coming in, at least at some level, when you have fundamentally, as we do here, a written contract. Part three of the definition of a credit agreement, which I've managed to walk up here without, plainly references the word omission. Well, by definition, an omission will never be in writing, but it plainly is included within the definition of a credit agreement. And here, when you've got the kind of full-scale evidentiary written record from the bank, a promissory note, change of terms, voluminous correspondence, significant bank records that demonstrate what the bank was doing, none of the vices that the Kassoff statute was intended to prevent are implicated at all. And for all of those reasons, even though I got an extra minute, I won't take it all. For all of those reasons, we request reversal and remand for a new trial on plaintiff's claims as outlined in our brief, and for reversal and judgment in favor of Mr. Fisher on the counterclaim. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. All right, the bailiff may announce.